Well, good evening. It's an honor to be in this pulpit and address you on the topic of music. There's a great deal of interest, as you know, in worship and worship music today. While I was writing my book in the late 90s, contemporary Christian music, or CCM, was well established. But contemporary worship music, or CWM, was still in the experimental stages. Some 15 or 20 years later, all that has changed. Both CCM and CWM have now become part of the very identity of evangelicalism. They are joined at the hip. The chapel services at many, if not most, American Christian colleges feature contemporary worship. Some Christian colleges even offer degrees in contemporary Christian music or contemporary worship. And there is now a contemporary music center, which is run by the leading evangelical consortium of colleges and universities. So that is the state of the situation. But contemporary worship music will not be the topic of my lectures. Others are much more qualified than I am on this topic. The leading American scholar in this field is Dr. Scott Anio, who has just published another book in this field. My lectures are going to deal with something different but more fundamental, such as how music communicates, what it can communicate, and how we apprehend what it communicates. We'll also be looking at aesthetics and how sound theology contribute to our debate. That will be for the next two sessions. Also, rather than an abstract approach to these issues, I will focus on misconceptions that have grown up around this topic, which have also led to the kind of careless musical integration that we witness in the church today. Throughout these lectures, I will be referring to two competing philosophies, that of the musical pluralist and that of the musical purist. The pluralist advocates the integration of all musical styles with Christian lyrics, precisely because they believe that no style is inherently sinful or unredeemable. The purist, on the other hand, resists integration because he believes that form and content cannot be divorced. He's especially suspicious about modern Western genres such as rock and pop. As you may have already realized, the purist, or anyone who would dare question the synergy of rock and gospel, finds himself isolated and marginalized today. In fact, the pluralist position has won the hearts and heads of most believers. But this victory has been won at the expense of critical thinking and sound musicology. In his 1871 book, The Descent of Man, Charles Darwin remarked that, quote, music must be ranked among the most mysterious predilections with which man is endowed, unquote. In fact, even modern evolutionists have a difficult time accounting for the human impulse to make music. And that's understandable because their anthropology lacks the imago Dei, the image of God. But ironically, it's the secularists like these that have a more credible and intelligent grasp of musical meaning and communication than many Christians. I think it's primarily because they are not squeamish about identifying certain emotions with certain styles of music, as we will see shortly. Popular Christian musicology, on the other hand, is by comparison simplistic and naive. In fact, CCM has been so gullible that it has co-opted the vocabulary of the sexual revolution, that is rock and roll, all the while insisting that its patrons exercise moral purity. So what I want to look at this evening are some fundamental misconceptions of music that pluralists hold. And in the process, I'm going to also deal with one that purists hold. So let's get right into it. It's best to begin with a definition of music And my definition will involve what music is and what it isn't. There have been other definitions. For example, Aaron Copland, the composer, taught that music had five properties: melody, rhythm, harmony, timbre, and form. And this is a very useful definition, but mine will be both more basic and more philosophical at the same time. So let's begin with the basics. Music is ordered and sustained sound. The sound part is fairly obvious. Music cannot involve total silence. It doesn't just happen in the mind, and it can't be just notes on a page. It has to happen in the material world. But it's not just sound, because the sound must be ordered or have a pattern to it that you can identify. Further, this pattern should be sustained for some period of time. But ordered and sustained sound is insufficient as a definition, because something like a heartbeat would qualify as ordered and sustained sound. So we have to improve it. And we improve it by adding the element of creative intelligence. Music must be the product of creative intelligence, not randomness or instinct. The sound of waves crashing on the seashore is not music, because it has no meaningful variation. As creative intelligence, music must come from personal beings with self-consciousness, not animals. Animals can said to be sing. For example, birds sing, and there is an order and a pattern to it, but it's not creative, it's instinctive. Their singing also has a practical goal of communicating important information to other birds, and therefore it's more like our speech than it is our music. We need to go further. Music is also an expression of this personal being with creative intelligence to another like being. This means that information is being communicated. But this information has its limits. Music is not a language that can communicate on the level of words. Musical instruments, for example, cannot give you directions to the airport. But music can express feelings, moods, emotions, and images, and sometimes better than words. Take, for instance, Winston Churchill's famous "We Shall Never Surrender" speech delivered to the House of Commons in 1940. Although the content of that great speech cannot be conveyed by musical instruments, its majesty, resolve, and solemnity can be expressed with an orchestra. Finally, music must contain beauty. That is, music has to appeal to something very deep within us, something that cannot be adequately described, just experienced. The appreciation of beauty is limited to image bearers alone. Even an intelligent animal like a dog cannot appreciate the beauty of a waterfall or even its own beauty. Think of it another way. A message in Morse code also has ordered and sustained sound and is an expression of creative intelligence, but it isn't beautiful. It doesn't touch our artistic sensibilities. We may define beauty in music differently, but the point is that music evokes a sense of beauty and artistic appreciation within us. Anything that is called music but lacks one or more of these elements is not really music. I'll go through a couple of these as examples. A painting is not music because it doesn't have the property of sound, although it has order, expression, creative intelligence, and beauty. The sound of a diesel engine is not music, though its sound has a certain order and even rhythm to it, but it's not expressive or creative, and it certainly isn't beautiful. A bird can sing, producing ordered and sustained sound, but it expresses, and it can express something which may even be beautiful to us, but it isn't. It is instinctive, not intelligent or creative, and therefore it is not music. So I've completed my definition of music, and we will build on that and move on from that. I want to look now at how music communicates and how it doesn't communicate, and we'll begin with a flawed model of musical communication. Purists have largely espoused what is has been called the hypodermic model of musical meaning. Basically, this means that music affects us directly, controlling us much like an alcoholic beverage or a drug. This is evident in a great deal of protest literature from purists. I'll read a few of these quotations from you. Quote, another important reason why rock music cannot legitimately be Christianized is that its hypnotic beat can alter the mind, weaken the moral sensitivities and inhibitions, and cause people to write and see and do the most hideous things. Unquote. Another one says, the steady pounding can cause the mind to go into a state of daydreaming in which it loses touch with reality. This in turn causes the dancer to lose touch with a value system related to reality. Any monotonous, lengthy, rhythmic sound induces various stages of trances. It is quite obvious to any qualified, objective observer that teenagers dancing to rock often enter hypnotic trances. When control of the mind is weakened or lost, evil influences can often take possession. The hypodermic model, then, is the prevailing paradigm of musical meaning and effect among purists, and with good reason. When we listen to music, its impact feels immediate and intuitive. It is direct. We're not conscious of the fact that the music must first travel through an interpretive maze before it registers in our soul and creates an emotional response. Because of its automatic and reflexive nature, we tend to believe that music will have the identical impact on every occasion and on every person. But the hypodermic view of music is easily refuted and unable to account for the evidence. In the first place, it doesn't tally with the biblical witness in 1 Samuel. If music affected us without mediation and interpretation, then Saul would not have been successful in resisting the soothing musical therapy of David, recorded in 1 Samuel 18 and 19. I'll read from chapter 18. Now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved inside his house while David was playing music with his hand as times before. And there was a spear in Saul's hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. It is evident that David's instrumentals were unable to relieve Saul on these occasions. It's safe to assume that Saul was able to block out and resist the power of the music, and contrary to the intended effect of the music, tried to murder David in cold blood. Also, the hypodermic model cannot account from the evidence from human experience. How often have we heard heavy metal guitar riffs in restaurants or at work without them engendering some deviant form of behavior within us? For these reasons and many others, I propose that the hypodermic model ought to be discarded. The better model sees music as a relationship of sign and referent. It is called the semiotic model of music. Like speech, music also has a lexicon of notes and chords with a syntax. And these act as symbols for things outside of music itself. Music as symbol represents feelings, moods, emotions, ideas, and images, and we as listeners make intuitive connections between the musical symbols that we hear and the emotions that they represent. How, for example, can music represent anger? Well, how do angry people behave? They tend to act in haste, to be eruptive, and sometimes disorderly. They also tend to be loud and tense. Music can represent anger by itself being abrupt, sudden, and authoritative, using great volume and tension that that escalates into an explosion. Let's look at another example, sadness. How does music represent that? Well, how do sad people behave? They tend to move slowly, speak softly, and their reactions are not jerky or abrupt. Music can represent sadness by itself being slow and having soft tones. The intervals between the tones are small. The number of instruments are few, such as a lone flute to stand for the aloneness that we feel when we're sad. And we can actually test this type of theory. If someone were to take a tune with sad characteristics and claim that it represents joy and happiness, and then we could point out that people who are joyful do not exhibit the characteristics of slow, soft music with minimal instruments. So then, music represents emotions by reproducing them in sound. And this type of musical decoding takes place every time we listen to familiar music, and it happens so instantly that most of us are unaware of the process. According to the semiotic model that I'm endorsing, music communicates much like language, where meanings are assigned to symbols that we call words. Although music differs in many critical ways from language, it is much closer to language than, say, it is to a pain reliever or a sedative. Like language, music is mediated and it can be understood. And this is not just my conclusion, but it has some recent scientific backing to it. Neuroscientists at the University of Montreal discovered that Westerners generally agree on the emotional expression of songs using Western tonal elements. Even when more complex emotions were tested, the results were the same. The examined accurately identified the emotions. Now, this agreement can even transcend culture. Other neuroscientists, this time at a university in Leipzig, exposed non-Westerners from Cameroon to some classical piano pieces, and the results were the same. The Cameroons accurately identified the emotions represented in the piano excerpts as happy, sad, or scary. So then, by subscribing to the semiotic model of music, not only will purists be standing on more credible musicological ground, but they can also maintain their position that music can profoundly influence mood and behavior. And I sincerely believe that. This is evident in the success of the Muzak service, or elevator music, if you're familiar with that term. Muzak manipulates the behavior of listeners for commercial profit. It can slow down shoppers, speed up factory workers, and calm patients in a waiting room, and on and on. And all that through symbol and referent, not hypodermic. The effectiveness of the semiotic model can be demonstrated by one of the most vigorous opponents of the hypodermic model. His name is, he is rock historian Robert Walser. Listen to this quote. And keep in mind, he rejects the semiotic model. He believes in, he rejects the hypodermic model, and he holds to the semiotic model. Quote, "At the end of an Iron Maiden concert, light, happy Muzak-style music came through the PA system to accompany the crowd's exit. This music was clearly intended to disperse the energy of the concert, promoting an orderly exit and calm reintegration with the world outside. It succeeded remarkably. 15,000 screaming, sweating, heavy metal fans were transformed into a group as sedate as any symphony orchestra fans." Unquote. Now let's move on. We're done with the semiotic model. Let's move on from the fundamentals of music to the basics of musical pluralism. The basic axiom of the musical pluralist is that form and content are unrelated, or related only in a superficial way. In other words, the feelings of rebellion, anger, disorientation, and chaos that you receive when you hear the song Anarchy in the UK by the Sex Pistols, those feelings are purely accidental and unrelated to the music. If you inserted the lyrics of God Save the Queen to the same punk tune, you would come away with an entirely different set of feelings, noble, patriotic ones. The pluralist claims that the bad associations can change And any form of music can be redeemed for Christian service, entertainment, and even worship, as long as the lyrics are changed. Now, before I critique this, let me recite what some secular writers have said about the integration of rock and gospel. Carol Flake, in her book Redemptorama, says this, quote, "Christian musicians who didn't sanitize the secular styles faced a different problem. Often there was no organic link between the message and the style. Anti-rock crusaders were at least partially correct about Christian rock being a contradiction in terms. When no attempt was made to fuse form and content, the result was the creation of strange hybrid beasts that headed off in two directions at once." She continues, "There was something jarring and disjointed about a Christian message being delivered amid smoke bombs and screeches by a group like the Resurrection Band. It was like being handed a bouquet of lilies by a tattooed biker. This was not so much Christianized culture as enculturated Christianity." Secular sociologist Jay Howard and John Streck say the following, "Focused on what they're trying to say, evangelicals have spent little time seriously thinking about how to say it, and perhaps more important, about the environment in which it will be said. Evangelical culture, therefore, is left largely without an intellectual basis for critiquing media institutions or evaluating the influence that media have on the messages sent. Absent of any theoretical understanding of culture and or the media, evangelicals blindly assume the neutrality of media and use them uncritically." Gwen Ifill, my next quotation, she is a very well-known reporter in the United States, interviewed Grammy Award winner Yolanda Adams about pop and the gospel. Ifill said, quote, "Now, sometimes when I listen to hip-hop music, I'll be bopping my head along, and all of a sudden it will occur to me that they are saying Jesus, or they're talking about God. And it takes me a while before I realize I'm listening to a gospel song. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?" Now, here is Yolanda Adams' response to Gwen Ifill. Quote, "That's a great thing. Because you said I'm bopping my head up and down. So you're already into the beat, and this is what we're trying to do with the young people. They hear the music, and they're like, wow, that's cool. Then if a cool person is singing about Jesus, well, then it's pretty cool to know Jesus." Unquote. At least Yolanda Adams is being very honest. She's essentially saying that we are trying to lure young people into trying out a Jesus who is the way, the truth, and the life of the party. Earlier, I'm moving on here. Earlier, I explained how sadness and anger can be represented in music. Now let me show you how rock can express transgression. It does so through extremely high volume and overload to represent a violation of boundaries. By imitating audibly and visibly behavior that is related to aggression, anger, discord, and rebellion. Let's look at the audible part first. This involves creating sounds that are chaotic and raw and brutal. Rock journalist Robert Pattison says the following. Listen to this. "Its admirers wanted to make rock appealing by making it respectable. The thing can't be done. Rock is appealing because it is vulgar. Rock is the quintessence of vulgarity. It is crude, loud, and tasteless." Unquote. Ellen Willis, a well-known author on rock music, states the following. "Although the music has changed over the years, the rebellious urges that created it remain the same. I was reminded once more of the basic appeal of rock and roll. Its irreverent, nose-thumbing quality," unquote. Transgression is also represented in rock by the use of electric guitar distortion, also known as fuzz box. Guitar distortion represents extreme power overflowing its channels. The distortion is accompanied by vocal distortion, screams and shouts, as the capacities of the vocal cords are exceeded. Here is what some record producers, these are again secular record producers, say about distortion. Distortion is the flag waver of their rebellious generation. Think about Jimi Hendrix, The Who, and the Rolling Stones, and you think of those wonderful distorted guitar sounds. Another one says, distortion is the sound of adolescence. It's anger. It's out of control, unquote. Now, having covered the audible, let's look at the visible part of the representation. Transgression is represented there by self-assertive and boastful posturing, intimidating stares, and snarling teeth. It's also represented by stage histrionics, which in some genres include smashing guitars in concert. So far, then, the evidence points to the fusion of form and content, not its separation. Let me move on. Let's look at another flawed model of musical communication. Just as the purists are guilty of the hypodermic view, so many pluralists are guilty of adopting the associational view of musical meaning. Under this system, an entire song or genre can take on a certain meaning based on the context of its performance. Harold Best, an outspoken evangelical purist or pluralist, uses this model to support his view that music, quote, has no interior beacon that guarantees permanent meaning. Unlike truth, which is transcultural, absolute, and unchangeable, music can shift in meaning from place to place and time to time, unquote. He uses an example. It's from the tune for the hymn, Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken, which had a long history of secular service in anthems and concerts. He indicates that this tune has no sacred meaning. And the reason is that once it was attached to the German national anthem, Deutschland über alles. And when Jews would listen to this, they were reminded of the Holocaust and deeply offended by it. He also, that is, Best uses an example of a young man who was once in a satanic cult that used Bach's music for its liturgies. When the man was later converted as a Christian, he was terrified whenever he heard the same music played in church. That's Bach's music. He was terrified by it. And therefore, Best concludes, there is no other way to explain this phenomenon other than that music as music is completely relative. Now, I'll respond to this. We don't have to come to the same conclusion as Dr. Best. There is a better explanation for what he has observed. The actual music for Deutschland über alles, when divorced from any context, could be described as reverent, majestic, serious, orderly, and even joyous. What has changed is the larger context with which the music is associated. Strong reactions have occurred not to the musical language itself, but to a negative setting, which includes lyrics, that the musical piece has triggered in somebody. But this is not a support for polarizing form and content. In the same way, if a happy song was playing in the waiting room of the hospital, when the surgeon informed you that your father did not survive the bypass operation, that happy song would be a source of great sorrow for you simply because of its association with that painful event. The song has become so, or it's become offensive and sad by accidental association alone, not by any sad properties in the music itself. Most importantly, this example reveals that associational meaning can take place with lyrics, not just music. And Harold Best says that lyrics are clear carriers of propositional truth. I'm going to read to you a quotation by Stephen Davies, a musicologist, who recognizes how the associational view of music actually distorts our understanding of how music means. Quote, "If now I am delighted by the slow movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 because I happened to be listening to it when I received news of my lottery win, then my delight is not to be counted as a response to the music as such. Put another way, the variety of response labeled as "they're playing our song" is to be dismissed, since responses of this type result from private associations that music that such music calls to mind rather than from attention to features of the music, which is what I was saying. Therefore, the associational model should be dismissed and discarded. The next pluralist argument holds that the morality of music is found in the lyrics and not in the style of the music. The underlying assumption is that a word is somehow naturally related to the thing that it refers to and is inseparably chained to it. We don't think about the fact that in most cases there is no natural connection between a word and the object to which it refers. If the sound of a word was naturally related to the object that it stood for, every language in the world would call man's best friend a dog. But we know that that's not true. The meaning of words is not locked in tight. It can change when the context of the utterance changes. Linguists know that words do not carry meaning apart from context, and context includes the way in which the words are delivered. Something as minor as tone and volume can disrupt and change the meaning of words. Nonverbal messages that accompany lyrics are known by linguists, are called meta-messages, and they include things like body language and tone. According to Dr. T. David Gordon, meta-messages sometimes carry a different or even conflicting message from our verbal message, unquote. Now, if this is true of things like tone and body language, then how much more about musical style that accompanies a song? Most musicologists recognize that musical context influences the way in which the words are interpreted. Here is what Robert Walter, a rock historian that I quoted earlier, says about this. Before any lyrics can be comprehended, before harmonic or rhythmic patterns are established, timbre instantly signals genre and effect. Imagine this text being done by AC/DC with raucous screaming and pounding. I hear footsteps and there's no one there. I smell blossoms and the trees are bare. Now compare Frank Sinatra crooning the same lyrics backed by strings. The musical cues create very different effects. One is a frantic agony of paranoia. The other is the delicious disorientation of bourgeoisie love, unquote. Now, what Walser is saying is that the lyrics, I hear footsteps and there's no one there, I smell blossoms and the trees are bare, would mean something totally different if AC/DC sang them than if Sinatra sang them. But they're the same lyrics. Walser continues, but I would argue that musical codes are the primary bearers of meaning. Lyrics like costume and performers' physical motions help direct and inflect the interpretation of the meanings that are most powerfully delivered. They are the ones that the music delivers. Simon Frith emphasizes the priority of the music over the lyrics in rock communication. Quote, sociologists of popular music have always fallen for the easy terms of lyrical analysis. Such a word-based approach is not helpful at getting at the meaning of rock. Most rock records make their impact musically rather than lyrically. The words, if they are noticed at all, are absorbed after the music has made its mark. The crucial variables are the sound and the rhythm. Other sociologists say much the same. So then I think it's safe to conclude that the supremacy of the lyrics is another naive assumption that pluralists hold. Now we can transition from the simplistic to the sophisticated. That is, one of the most sophisticated arguments that pluralists hold is that today's rock enthusiasts do not perceive or interpret the music in the same terms as the older generation. That is, what may sound like a bunch of noise to purists is not necessarily what it means to the rock patron who enjoys the music. One pluralist says, quote, however, bear in mind that there is a certain amount of cultural relativity to what message a sound communicates. In other words, a distorted rock guitar may communicate rebellion to one person, yet to a fan, it may communicate a sense of joy or power, unquote. Leonard Bernstein, the composer, once performed a test with young people to demonstrate that a musical piece can have multiple meanings. He took various classical pieces with strong emotive qualities and replaced the stories and intentions of the composers with his own. Bernstein found that the listeners agreed with him and basically fell for his fraud, no matter how far he strayed from the intention of the composer. And so this was proof to Bernstein that music has multiple meanings, or at least the potential for multiple meanings. Bernstein is engaged in what is known as meaning negotiation. This means that symbols are capable of various meanings as the individual negotiates with the symbol to achieve a meaning that reflects his own set of experiences, values, and grids. Try something here. If you can see my hand making the circle here, they will use an example like this. This can, to some, in some cultures, represent nothing, a zero. But in others, it can represent perfection. The circle closes. It's become perfect. Perfect, you see. And that is an example of multiple meanings and meaning negotiation. Direct your own thoughts toward it, okay? Now let me offer a response to this. One of the dangers of meaning negotiation is that it removes authorial intention in art, music, and literature. It doesn't matter so much what the author intended to convey, according to the negotiation view, only what you think it means or what you want it to mean. Now, this is a very postmodern way of approaching meaning and communication, and it is dangerous because it obliterates communication. Also, some symbols are naturally related to the reference rather than conventionally and can't rightly be negotiated. This one can, but there are others that can't, and I will give you that example from the Bible itself. Revelation 19:8 says, it was granted to her that she should be clothed with bright white linen, for the linen is the righteousness of the saints, unquote. Now, bright white linen represents righteousness for good reasons, not arbitrary reasons, because the colors white and bright represent moral purity by being devoid of any dirt, discoloration, or impurities. It also will contrast the darkness of night, its dread and its limitations and things like that. It would be very awkward to say that the filthy, dull linen represents the righteousness of the saints, or the bright white linen represents the unrighteousness of the wicked, wouldn't it? So there is an organic link here between the symbol and its reference. Also, or likewise, many of the symbols in music are organically linked to the emotions that they represent, as we already saw in the case of sadness, anger, and transgression. Now let's get back to Bernstein's example, if I haven't already lost you. If you recall, Bernstein basically deceived his audience by having them listen to classical pieces and then convince them of a meaning that was different than that of the original. Nevertheless, Bernstein could have accomplished the same thing with the lyrics of many songs, as well as some literature. Linguists know that many of the ambiguities that pluralists detect in music also exist in language. Christians who advocate this type of musical pluralism, that is the pluralists, are guilty of accepting a very naive doctrine of human language as being entirely precise and unambiguous. But the truth is that texts do not communicate to their fullest extent without certain contextual aids, some of which are unavailable. So then, both music and language require contextual aids to signify more specifically and accurately what they mean. When it comes to rock and roll, meaning is not dependent on the music alone. I'm going to get into meta messages now, such as body language and tonal inflection, that all enhance the meaning of this particular genre. The first meta message that can subvert the meaning of the lyrics is tonal inflection. Certain tonal inflections are characteristic of certain styles of music. Vocals in American bluegrass, for example, tend to be nasally and high in pitch. Inflections in opera tend to be highly refined, florid, with extended articulation that stretches the limits of the vocal cords in order to achieve some type of elegance. Rock inflections are also important indexes of mood and attitude. A very common, in fact, really cliche in pop music is the practice of scooping. That is, sliding up to the note from below the pitch. The singer begins slightly off pitch and gradually moves into the pitch. Sometimes you'll be listening to a song in church and you'll hear this, but you're not quite sure what it is. You elbow your spouse and say, "That sounds very contemporary," but you don't know why, because it really doesn't have the drums or the usual accompaniment, and it's probably because you're hearing scooping and don't really know what to call it. Scooping is often combined with a deliberately aspirated voice, that is a whispery, breathy voice that mimics the intimacy of lovers. Compounding the sensual effect is the custom of singing within a razor's edge of the microphone, which dramatically increases the level of felt intimacy. Many rock styles require a lengthening, slurring, and to some degree distortion of the lyrics to mirror the impairment of speech and disorientation that it accompanies a drug-intoxicated experience. My pet name for this is bloodshot vocals. Many of the harder genres add to this highly guttural tones, sometimes resembling animal grunts. At times, you witness the high-pitched scream of the depraved and the whine of the disillusioned. The tones are almost always cynical and edgy, even in the lighter rock genres. These are meta messages. Tonal inflections are powerful meta messengers, as the following example will demonstrate. In 1962, during a birthday salute to John F. Kennedy, American icon Marilyn Monroe sang the innocent lyrics of "Happy Birthday" to Kennedy in a manner that entirely changed the meaning of the words in the song. She gasped, blew, and panted the words across to Kennedy in one of the most accessible, cross-cultural, and sexually obvious flirts in recorded history. An innocent, happy, cheerful children's song was transformed into sexual invitation simply by Monroe's estrogen-induced vocals. It's on YouTube or the internet. If you don't believe me, go ahead and search and you will see for yourself. Let me move on to another meta message. Another overlooked factor in the contention that Christian lyrics change the meaning of rock music is the meta message of dancing. We must ask, if the meaning of the music has been transformed by Christian lyrics, why haven't the accompanying dance styles changed? As an art form, dancing is more easily apprehensible and its meaning is more transparent than music. The way I like to put it is that dancing is the shadow that music casts. Sometimes the shadow of an object is much sharper and clearer than the object itself, at least to our eyes. So, Many times, dancing acts as a shadow or commentary on the music, articulating visibly and physically what the music means audibly and emotionally. The erotic nature of rock-related aphrodisiac dancing has been sufficiently documented. I've devoted an entire chapter to it in my book, if you're interested. But even without scholastic documentation, the lewd punctuation of rock's aphrodisiac dancing is obvious. An American scholar by the name of Dale Brueggemann put it this way. He asked Christian rockers the following question, quote, "How are you going to sing about a God whose eyes are too holy to look upon sin?" and emphasize that point with a pelvic thrust. I think you get the idea. So then the retention of aphrodisiac dance forms within the music itself in CCM is a strong indication that the words have not changed the erotic signification of the music. I'm moving on to another topic. Because the case for the interrelationship of form and content is so convincing, some pluralists are admitting that the rock genre does in fact express emotions such as anger, transgression, rebellion, even eroticism. But at the same time, they also insist that these things are not evil in themselves. It's rather the object of these emotions that makes them good or bad. For example, anger is not evil unless it's directed against something wrong. Anger against sin, though, is good. Anger is an attribute of God. We are commanded to be angry and sin not, and so forth. Likewise, it's believed that rebellion can also be compatible with Christian conversation. Mark Stewart of the group Audio Adrenaline claims the following, quote, "Christianity is about rebellion. Jesus Christ was the biggest rebel to ever walk the face of the earth. He turned the world upside down and was crucified for his rebellion. Rock and roll is about the same thing, rebellion," unquote. According to this new approach, even sexual desire as a musical emotion must not be condemned out of hand. A pluralist, Greg Strawbridge, compares the evil sexual desire of 1 Timothy 5:11 with passages of virtual sexual desire in the Song of Solomon. Now, I will respond to that. There are major and serious problems with this position. Firstly, it mistakenly assumes that anger, as articulated in rock, particularly in heavy metal, reflects the Christian concept of righteous indignation. It doesn't realize that the vintage of anger that is expressed in heavy metal is unfettered and overflowing. For example, the music of the Christian metal group, Barnabas, was promoted as, quote, "unbridled musical aggression." On the other hand, Christian anger, when warranted, is controlled, submissive, limited, and circumscribed by the warning not to sin, Ephesians 4:26. Its desire is to resolve the cause of the anger rather than to unleash it at its object. Even if musical representation of this righteous indignation was violent, is this the type of thing that we would want to incarnate into a genre of music for aesthetic purposes? That is, should we internalize or inhale unbridled musical aggression as a means of artistic pleasure and entertainment, as a source of meditation, as a vicarious influence on behavior, or as a vehicle of worship? Not according to Philippians 4:8. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are good, or of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Anger is easily distorted, opposed to reason and restraint, and results in irrational speech and actions. That's why Paul had to insert the proviso in 4:26, "and yet do not sin." And then he follows that by saying, "and do not give the devil a foothold," because even righteous indignation can easily mutate into sin. Now let's look at the issue of rebellion. You will recall the outrageous claim of Mark Stewart that Christianity is about rebellion and that Jesus is the biggest rebel to ever walk the face of the earth. Some even consider Rock to be healthy protest instead of rebellion and attempt to legitimate it in that sense. Let me respond to Stewart first. There are many metaphors in that the Bible uses to depict members of the Trinity, but none of them is as a rebel. We read of God as a shepherd, husband, a warrior, a monarch, a father, and even a midwife, but never as a lawless thug. The theme is not found in Scripture. Now to the idea that it is healthy protest and can be sanctified for that purpose. At least this is an admission that Rock communicates some kind of rebellion. Earlier, CCM denied this outright. But Rock's rebellion is not interchangeable with any kind of lawful protest, like signing a petition to keep a prison out of your neighborhood. At its most basic level, rebellion involves opposition to some established convention. But that is not the limit of Rock's rebellion. Rock opposes, through its very form, the biblical worldview of order, absolutes, physical control and restraint, balance, beauty, and purity. Therefore, its rebellion is against God's transcendent order and not just a neutral or healthy protest. Finally, happy for that, since form is neutral to the pluralists, what we ought to be concerned about, according to the pluralists, is the spirit or the inward disposition of the individual who sings. So then it is good intentions that are really what please God, not the style of the genre. And this is ubiquitous in CCM. I quoted earlier the sociologists Howard and Streck, and I'm going to quote them again here. Quote, "The conclusions drawn are framed in individualistic terms that ignore completely the social structures of the industry. The idea is pervasive in Christian music. John W. Stile, the producer of Contemporary Christian Music magazine, wonders whether God is pleased with the industry. He then proceeds to sidestep the question by reducing the industry to its constituent individuals, concluding that individuals' attitudes are more important than their activities and that our hearts mean more to God than our habits. It is difficult to critique an industry if only the attitudes of the individuals' hearts, something further argued to be beyond the measure of humankind, are deemed important. The approach ignores the possibility that anti-Christian practices have been embedded into the structures of the industry. Thus, hard questions go unasked as well as unanswered." Unquote. Gary Weaver, who teaches philosophy at the University of Delaware, gives a more Christian perspective on this. Quote, "I'm quite willing to grant the good intentions, but to insist that good intentions are enough seems too close to ancient and modern heresies. Saying that it is my own private thoughts and intentions that determine the character of my Christian life at least flirts with Gnostic thinking and other special non-Catholic revelations. It also risks a Manichaean rejection of the corporeal world as a proper realm of divine salvific activity, and perhaps even a dichotomizing of the blatantly corporeal narrative of the Old Testament from a supposedly more spiritual and thus private New Testament gospel of salvation." My apologies to the deaf signer on that convoluted sentence. I don't know if you could do anything with that, but you're brave to even try. Let me continue with Weaver. I think this next section is also worth it. "Yet this inward and personal understanding of Christianity is characteristic of much contemporary Protestantism, both evangelical and mainline. Methodist theologian Stanley Hauerwas has observed that post-Enlightenment Protestantism is unusual in Christian history for assuming that being a Christian reduces to questions of one's state of mind, whether those questions be matters of confessional doctrine or evangelical decisions to, quote, accept Jesus Christ as my personal Savior, unquote. Now, if you didn't pick any of that up, That's okay, because I'll boil it down. What these writers are observing is that within CCM is that most evangelicals today are trained to think with their glands instead of their heads. This approaches the Mormon assurance test known as the burning in the bosom. Now, I don't want to minimize experience in the Christian life. We've all felt the conviction of the Holy Spirit. We've all experienced the love of God. But if we conclude from that the only thing that matters in worship and music is sincerity, as the pastor was saying this morning, then we lose touch with our own sinful nature and impaired faculties. As a result, we can sincerely approve of something that God does not. Those who endorse this conception fall into the trap of thinking that the conscience is sanctified and infallible. Now, this is kind of a segue into my lecture tomorrow that I will speak in greater detail. So it's an invitation to return. But Scripture teaches that the Christian conscience has been corrupted by sin. That is what 1 Corinthians 8 is all about. The person described in 1 Corinthians 8, 7 as a problem with a weak conscience. Let me read that to you. However, not all men have this knowledge, but some, being accustomed to the idol, until now eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. Unquote. Four more times this individual's conscience is referred to as weak in this chapter. Now, the specific weakness that this conscience has is that it is over-scrupulous. But by inference, it can also be under-scrupulous. That is, the conscience of a Christian can misjudge, it can be corrupted and defiled. In other words, it can suffer from the effects of depravity. And lastly, if the correct heart attitude sanctifies one's musical offering, does an improper heart attitude desecrate it? If so, how would we know either one? During some of the most productive days of her career, CCM icon Sandy Patty was living in adultery while she was singing and making records. Who but those who were closest to her in her hometown were able to know that she was unfaithful to her husband? And moreover, who is in a position to judge the heart attitude of a performer so as to exalt the heart attitude as the chief concern that we should have?